Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today, a bipartisan effort to reduce the possibility of another attack on municipal water systems in New Jersey.
Reporting and government advisors have linked the cyber attacks to Iranian-affiliated actors, though officials are also looking into whether other enemies were involved.
I'll chat with legendary songwriter, producer, and Stax Records icon David Porter about his new memoir, The Soul Man.
And Soul Man was talking about education and being motivated to have pride and self and all of those kinds of things. So I felt that that was going to be a number one record. And I voiced that. Matter of fact, I made a little wager on that.
And WBGO's John Kalish introduces us to The Cranky.
Someone started a Facebook group called Crankies in the Puppet World and Beyond, and now there are 4,500 people in the group from all over the world.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. New Jersey U.S. Congressman Josh Gottheimer came to Park Ridge this week to announce his bipartisan Critical Infrastructure Security Plan, a package of federal actions to bolster American critical infrastructure following a wave of attacks that targeted New Jersey municipal water systems and others in at least a dozen states across the country. Over the past 2 weeks, hackers have targeted water systems in the Garden State. In Cape May County, two municipal systems were hit, forcing operators to manually turn valves and run pumps after the digital controls they rely on every day were wrenched away from them. This is Congressman Gottheimer.
With the explosion and advancement of AI, these threats have become even more common, easier, and more deadly. And unfortunately, far too easy for access for those who seek to do us harm, specifically enemies like Iran, Russia, and the government of China. I'm not here to scare any of us. I'm just here for a dose of reality. As a member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the ranking member of the Subcommittee on the National Security Agency and Cyber, I want us all to be aware of and prepared for this reality that we're facing here at home. Because if you're prepared and you know about it, you can get ahead of it. And that's our goal, to make sure we get ahead of it before there's a major problem. Today, I'm proud to announce my Critical Infrastructure Security Plan to give towns, counties, and states the tools they need to protect our families and the water, electric, and other critical infrastructure systems that they rely on from cyber attacks. I'm standing here because it's in towns like this one, all over the country, that the deal we have with our utility companies has been put in real jeopardy. And if we don't get ahead of it, as I said, it can mean a disaster for our families. It started in Minnesota in late July when hackers hit roughly 32 water systems in a single 48-hour window. Then it spread to Michigan, New Jersey, Minnesota, Georgia, South Dakota, and five other states. The FBI is investigating these incidents right now, and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, the FBI and the EPA, had to put out a joint advisory telling the entire water sector to immediately lock down its systems. So let's be straight about these latest 12-state attack on our country. Reporting and government advisories have linked the cyber attacks to Iranian-affiliated actors. That's what public information shows, though officials are also looking into whether other enemies were involved. This isn't some kid in the basement messing around in their boxer shorts. These are adversaries that we're facing. They know what they're doing. And with AI, it's become easier for them to do what they do.
Republican State Senator Holly Schapese also spoke at the news conference in Park Ridge.
It's my honor to be here. As you can see, this is a bipartisan issue that stems county, state, local, and federal. And we need every resource to ensure that our local water, our local electric companies are not subject to the sort of terroristic attacks that you're hearing about.
There are roughly 150,000 public water systems in the country, and 97% of them serve small communities such as Park Ridge, often with just a handful of employees and no full-time cybersecurity team. Many of these facilities were built decades ago for reliability, not for cybersecurity, leaving older controllers and outdated software exposed to anyone who knows where to look. Jeff Angermeyer is the Bergen County Chief of Detectives.
From an investigative and technical standpoint, the threat landscape surrounding critical infrastructure has fundamentally shifted these past few years. Sophisticated bad actors don't just try to steal financial data anymore. As all types of systems become increasingly connected, they also become targets. That is why infrastructure funding for cybersecurity and target hardening is vital. In Bergen County, we are proud of the many ways that the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office participates in that very mission. Prosecutor's Office Cyber Crimes Unit, our Intelligence and Counterterrorism Unit, and our Threat Management Unit maintain partnerships with key agencies like the FBI, like New Jersey's Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and the NJKIC. Together, we work daily to coordinate, share, and react to real-time threat intelligence, all while working with our local police, and most especially and particularly here as we stand here today, the Park Ridge Police Department and their municipal governing body. Simply put, upgrading and maintaining our digital perimeter is just as urgent as locking the front gate of a power station or a water utility.
Detective Jeff Angermeyer. Meanwhile, Congressman Gottheimer has announced three federal actions, including the introduction of the Bipartisan AI Cyber Defense Act, the Bipartisan Securing Our Critical Infrastructure Act, and sending a letter to CISA, the EPA, and the FBI, demanding they immediately surge incident response teams and technical assistance to every water and wastewater utility hit by this campaign, especially the small and rural systems that can least afford to go dark. Legendary songwriter, producer, and Stax Records icon David Porter has released his new memoir, The Soul Man, The Life of Songwriter David Porter. As one of the architects of soul music, Porter's extraordinary career has influenced generations of artists and helped shape the sound of American music. Best known for co-writing timeless classics, including Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, and numerous hits for Sam and Dave, David Porter offers a fascinating look at his life, career, and the legacy of Stax Records in his new book. And I am thrilled to have David Porter as my guest today on WBGO. David, great to see you.
Great seeing you as well, Doug. Glad to be with you and your audience, certainly.
Let's go back to the very beginning. You were born on November 21st, 1941, on what you have described as a dead-end street in the last house on Virginia Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee. But unlike many successful people in the entertainment business, you didn't have music going on much in your household. But there was a special place at the top of Virginia Avenue that changed everything for you. Can you tell us about that?
That was Rose Hill Baptist Church, a shotgun building at the top of that hill that was the gathering place for people in those particular times, in the 40s and 50s and those earlier years, to get emotionally energized to go forward for the next day because of the life experiences that they were going through. They were able to find a way to find that peace inside of that shotgun church. And my mother was beautiful enough to engage me emotionally with it in such a way that it changed my life.
It certainly did. And we'll talk about some of the gospel influences and some of the iconic hits you had, like Soul Man. But I first want to talk about an encounter that you had. My dad, Spike, sold insurance for more than 35 years. He met all kinds of interesting people during that time. You met someone very special while you were an insurance salesman. He was a meat packer at the time. How does that story go?
Well, actually, I met him long before I started selling insurance. We were high school students at rival high schools. I was a student at a high school known as Booker T. Washington High School. And as you know, back in those days of the times that they were, many of the African-American black schools were called Booker T. Washington. And so I was a part of Booker T. Washington High School in Memphis, Tennessee. He was a part of Manassas High School on the other side of the city. And his name was Isaac Hayes. And we would be able to see each other, not in a really seriously connecting way, because we just knew each other because of singing on Wednesday nights on a talent show on a very famous street in Memphis called Beale Street. And we were singing. He had a rival vocal group called the Teen Tones, and I had a vocal group called the Marquettes, and we were singing the doo-wop songs, trying to compete on the Wednesday night talent shows at the Palace Theater, trying to win $2 or $3 for first prize. And that was Isaac Hayes, and that was how we were actually able to meet each other and find out about the singing instincts. He was a bass singer. I was a lead singer. I was doing the Dell Vikings, and he was doing Get a Job. I can't call the name of the group right now, but he was the bass singer on that particular song. I recall that one because they won the first prize that week, because that song, Get a Job, was a big hit, and Isaac was the bass singer. As far as the first meeting him, as far as us talking with the experiences of the insurance encounters that I was having, I was selling insurance, and by that time had graduated from working at the grocery store across the street and introducing myself to these people in satellite recording studios, to now selling insurance to have more of an opportunity to do what my real passion was, which was singing. And I would be able to get out, sell insurance, find out more about music, find out what studio was available opportunity-wise there, and that kind of thing. So that's what I was doing. I would be out selling insurance, for trying to sell a dollar's worth of insurance per person, and then hanging at the recording studio across the street as trying to convince them to go into recording black music. They were a country label. They were not Stax. They were known as Satellite Records. And that was during the time that I was able to convince them to look seriously at going black music through an audition that I had. But that opportunity came from me selling insurance. It also gave me an opportunity to interact even more with Isaac Hayes.
That collaboration would lead to some of the most iconic hits that we have had, especially on Stax Records. I believe you were six when you started a gospel singing group. Is that right?
Well, very, very young. It wasn't like a gospel singing group in the truest sense of the words, but it was four kids who liked to sing together. And that was a young man by the name of Leander Cunningham, another young man by the name of Kelly Cunningham. And some people may not know those names, but they would know the name of Carl Cunningham, who was one of their brothers, they were the next door neighbor. And Carl Cunningham was the original drummer on the Barclays, who perished in an airplane crash with Otis Redding. Also across the street, four doors up from me, was a young man by the name of Maurice White. We call him Sandy, and Maurice was in Memphis, Tennessee. He was born in Memphis, and that's where he was raised, and that ended up being my best friend. And the four of us would go together to sing at Rose Hill Baptist Church, because that's where we were taken to participate in the service, and we simply just magnetically drew to the thrill of wanting to sing, and we started singing that at that particular time together. And we actually had a lot of positive energy doing that, but it was Rose Hill Baptist Church that made us become aware that there was some value to that.
Being a Hall of Fame songwriter, people would not be surprised to know that you played piano, but you also played trumpet.
Well, I don't profess to be what you call a true piano player. And because I started with the trumpet, but because I wanted to sing, I put the trumpet down and just focused totally on singing. And I had to, needless to say, have something that I could apply myself to in a dedicated way. And I found that rather than playing the instruments, singing was the path, and it ended up being the truest path for me.
So most people, when they see the book, are immediately going to start singing Soul Man. Let's go back to the days of Stax Records and that 1967 mega hit Soul Man from Sam and Dave. You were actually conducting them, I understand, during the song's production. You co-wrote the song with Isaac Hayes, and Steve Cropper was on guitar, Al Jackson Jr. on drums. It was a magical time. And did you know it at that time that this song would be so iconic?
Well, oddly enough, very few songs I would feel right out of the bat, I said, this is going to be a number one song. With Soul Man, it was different. I felt that Hold On, I'm Coming was going to be a hit record, but not so much that I was bragging about it and voicing it in such a more or less egotistical kind of way. But with Soul Man, after we'd completed that, and I felt that it was so on point to the audience that I thought it would gather the most. And at that time, you have to understand that we were of the ilk that the mindset would be because these records were going to be played on Black radio station. So Isaac and I's creative intent was to create the universality of our message, but also to put the underground message in that would apply to the audience that we know we were very easily to be connected to. And Soul Man was talking about education and being motivated to have pride in self and all of those kinds of things. So I felt that that was going to be a number one record. And I voiced that. Matter of fact, I made a little wager on that. So I felt that. That was one of those songs.
And one of the reasons, as you just mentioned, is the universality of this tune, that people from all colors would be singing this tune. It didn't matter what you look like. You right. Love the song, and that's success.
Exactly. You know, and I say this all the time, Doug, there are no new emotions. You have to find a fresh way to talk and communicate to common emotions if you want people to buy those. And so that was part of the technique that Isaac and I used to not bump into Motown or Bird Bacharach, Hal David writing. We had to find a fresh way to do it. And so that was the magic of Soul Man. The universality of that message was not only could relate to the people that we were targeting in a real concentrated way, but in a surface way, relate to anyone who wanted to be exceptional within themselves. And that's what a soul man represented. And the soul man could represent a soul person also. And so it could also be inspirational and motivational for females as well.
I recently saw a video that you gave. It was on Amazon Music. You took people through the studio and showed them exactly where everybody was, where Al Jackson Jr. had the drums, and where you were right in front of Sam and Dave as this was going on. How often do you think about that moment?
Well, that's a great question. I think about it very, very often, because we only had at Stax Records a core four-piece rhythm. Now, sometimes we incorporate Booker T. Jones playing organ or something on the session. That would make it five of the core rhythm section. But we only had those four musicians playing on all of the records that we wrote or produced. And so if you got bass, drums, guitar, and keys, you know, you have to find a way to find individuality and a uniqueness that separates in the ears of people when they hear the music. So we had to find a focused way to be sure that the individuality come through what we were doing. So Isaac and I would produce our songs, write our songs, and then orchestrate the implementation of not only the musical parts, but also the singing as well. So Sam and Dave would not be there when we would be writing the songs, they would come in, and then I have to teach them the song, and then give Sam or Ann or Dave the character of that particular section. And because they were learning it on the fly, I then would go in the back where the baffle was and the microphone, and direct them to cue them on parts that were extremely important for the sake of the song. For instance, Soul Man, Bobby Blue Bland was a hit star with blues records at that time, and he had what in the church we call a squall. Oh, Lord, that kind of squall kind of thing. I wanted that on Soul Man, and I wanted to place it in particular spaces on the records. So if you listen to Soul Man, I'm directing Sam with a finger for the squall, and he squalls, he does it. And because it's coming unexpected to him, he doesn't do it fully, but he does it just enough to make it perfect for the credibility of the song. So me standing on the other side of the microphone directing them was common, not only with Sam and Dave, with Johnny Taylor or Abbott King or whoever the Soul Children or whoever the artist we would be working with.
Did that church on the top of the hill, is still around?
That church on the top of the hill is gone. The houses on that dead end street are gone. On that street, Maurice, before he passed, he would come to Memphis and we would hang together. I would go to LA and we would hang together. And we would do it where no one would know. He would come into Memphis. This is at the apex of their career. We would go by classmates' houses in the evening, late at night, not too late, knock on their door, and Maurice White and David Porter would be standing at the door saying hi. It was that kind of thing. So Maurice would and I would go on Virginia Street and walk up the street. But years later, all of the houses were destroyed. The church was gone. And there are now old military trucks that populate that entire area. The street sign for the street is still there, but there are no homes there. And it is always sad to me when I pass that to see that.
Yeah, that is sad because just legendary music was inspired by that church. And I'm sure as that church was going on, anybody who's been at that kind of church knows the power of what you experience. And you did it at a certain age, and it really did change your life. Congratulations on this book. Once again, it is titled The Soul Man, The Life of Songwriter David Porter. It will tell you all about his life, Stax Records, and really what it takes to write a beautiful song and the emotion that's involved in it. Congratulations, Doug. David.
Doug, if I could say, if ones would like to get an autographed copy from me, they can go to davidportermemphismusic.com, send their information to me, and I will autograph the book to them personally and send it to them.
What more can you ask for?
Yeah. Also, they can get it on Amazon and that platform as well.
Last question. You going to write a new song after this book now? Has it inspired you to write a new song?
Here's the answer. I have never stopped writing songs, and I never will. Songs are my life. Music is my life. And I owe so much to it and to the people that have accepted.
Thanks, David. Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, sir.
To see you, baby, right now, yeah. But I know why I can't see you, oh, tonight. Cause I know you're tied up, and I'm free. And you got so much to lose.
You can see my entire interview with David Porter on the WBGO YouTube channel. A unique theatrical performance has been taking place during the International Puppet Fringe Festival in Manhattan this week. The show is being performed in a decidedly low-tech medium known as the Cranky. It's a portable stage with a panorama of characters and scenery scrolling by, accompanied by narration and music. WBGO's John Kalish has the story.
Painted, moving panoramas date back many centuries. They emerged as a popular form of entertainment in the 1800s and were constantly on tour in the U.S. and Europe. The Cranky is a small-scale version of the panorama, and its revival in America is traced back to the mid-2010s. Sue Truman is a Seattle-based artist who created the Cranky Factory website.
Someone started a Facebook group called Crankies in the Puppet World and Beyond. And when I joined that group, there were 30 people in the group. And now there are 4,500 people in the group from all over the world. It's just incredible how much it has exploded. And the U.S. remains the hub for cranky festivals and a lot of cranky performances.
The cranky performance of Sterna and the Lost Voice was created by the Magid Ensemble, a far-flung collective that includes a storyteller, a graphic artist, and three klezmer musicians. The heroine of this 50-minute cranky is a woman named Sterna.
In the town of Tuchin, there lived a physician named Sterna. She was a great healer, both in modern medicine and in the refuas, the remedies she learned from her baba and her baba's baba. She healed all those who came to her for aid, no matter who they were or whether they could pay, and was beloved by all for her kindness.
The narrator stands on the right side of the 2-foot-by-4-foot cranky box, and the three musicians are seated on the left. The artist who created the panorama stands behind the box, their upper body visible to the audience, as they crank the wooden dowels that advance the scroll of artwork.
I think all this scary AI art that is totally fake and unintelligible, I think people are moved by seeing something that's created in front of their eyes.
Brooklyn-based cellist Rafi Bowden is a member of the Magid Ensemble.
This is craft and artistry and musicianship and something really organic. This piece feels very complete, and it's a totally different performance experience. There's a story, a narrative, there's a really beautiful visual element, and it's all happening before your eyes.
In her quest to recover the voice of a beloved resident of her town, Sterna goes on a hero's quest to gather three magical items that will do the trick. In the process, she communes with the dead, encounters biblical prophets, and descends into the Garden of Eden thanks to a magical chariot.
It landed before her, the horses snorting sparks and dripping white stars from their foaming mouths. Sterna climbed into the chariot, and it took off above the sky.
Sterna and the Lost Voice has been performed more than 50 times around the U.S. and Canada in the last couple of years. Many of the shows have been sold out. The immersive nature of the cranky as a medium is credited with keeping children as young as preschoolers seated and watching the entire 50-minute show. Again, cellist Rafi Bowden.
Some of our first shows were for kids, and I was kind of fearing the worst because every time I worked with kids, it's hard to keep everybody's attention. But I think it felt like something they had never, ever seen before. It's very attention-grabbing and compelling. There were these characters moving on the screen, and it's moving at all times. It's like they're just watching an iPad.
The cranky renaissance in recent years has meant that larger venues are needed to accommodate the growing fan base. That, in turn, has made it difficult to actually see the visuals in the cranky for people seated far from the small stage. The solution at some performances is video projection, says cranky artist Sue Truman.
In a way, it's counterintuitive because one thing people like about it is that it's not digital. But on the other hand, if you can't see it, that's not good. In the festivals where I've performed, where they've provided the live video projection, I've heard nothing but good things about it and nobody complaining.
Sterna and the whole town's eyes closed, and all fell into a deep, sweet dream.
Sterna and the Lost Voice will be performed August 15th and 16th at Teatro Lattea on Manhattan's Lower East Side. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Thanks for listening to the show. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.